Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Blend Radio with Nancy and Lisa, the mother-daughter publishing team of Big Blend Magazines and hosts of Big Blend Radio, obviously, and full-time travelers on the Love Your Parks tour. Today, we're super excited to welcome theater expert and author Edwin Wong to the show. And he explores risk, chance, and unexpected, and the unexpected, I should say, in his newest book, When Life Gives You Risk, Make Risk Theater. It releases today, June 7th, 2022, through Friesen Press. And I encourage you to go to his website, risktheater.com. Of course, you can get the book on all online places like Amazon, but also follow him on Twitter, Theory of Tragedy. He's on Instagram under Edwin C. L. Wong and on Facebook, Edwin Charles Wong. And super excited to talk theater and to talk about risk, because I don't know, Nancy, you and I have a love affair with risk. It's the best thing on the planet. If you want to really live, play with the game of risk. So welcome, Edwin. How are you?
Never better. Thanks for having me on the show, Lisa and Nancy. Mm.
Hey, it's good to have you here. And you're up in Victoria, Canada. You gave us a little tour of your, was it the mud flats outside?
Mud flats, that's cool.
Beautiful, beautiful area. Have you always lived there?
This is a writer's paradise.
Oh, that's awesome. It's awesome. We love that whole area. It's a lot of rain, but I think that's a good thing. You need the rain. And I think
we need it
out in the Southwest where we are today. But really beautiful area, but very excited to talk about risk. Also to talk about theater. Before we get into the two books, tell us a little bit about your connection into theater and what got you started there and what prompted you to start picking up the pen in regards to books and, you know, because you're writing plays as well.
Oh, I got into theater. So I write essays about theater. And the way I got into theater was sort of backwards. Most people, when they get into theater, they know someone, they're a kid, they know someone that's in theater, they see a few shows, and then they fall in love with the theater. And then afterwards, they discover the academic side of theater. So for me, when I was a little boy, I was into philosophy of all things. I wanted to learn about philosophy, and I discovered a German philosopher's book, Friedrich Nietzsche. I wanted to learn more about him. And I was at the bookstore. They had a whole shelf of his books. He's got a ton of books. And I was just a kid. I didn't know what to get. And he had a book. It was called The Birth of Tragedy. And I thought, oh, that sounds like a really cool title. And I was in my teens. I'd been reading Hardy Boy books and comics. Yeah. I didn't know anything about this. But I got his book, and I was just blown away. I was like, wow, this guy can write. And he talked about tragedy and theater as the most important thing in the world. If you were to understand one thing in life, you had to get what tragedy was. So from that time, that's how I got into theater. I didn't know what theater was, but the way he talked about it, the Greek theater, like there was choruses and satyrs dancing around and Dionysus and Apollo. I had no idea of any of this, but I said, this is what I got to do. And then he studied Latin and Greek was how he got into theater. So I charted out my life, I enrolled, and I learned ancient Greek and Latin.
Wow.
And read ancient theater along the way. And then now I'm 47 now, so it's been a 30-year journey since when I was that little kid and I discovered this this philosopher. And then on the way, I got into theater. So I've directed a few staged readings now, and so now I'm on the academic side. And also I have some knowledge on the practical side now too. So
that's awesome. That's cool. Awesome. I think, you know, theater, it's funny because you write about Macbeth, and theater, that's one of the places that Macbeth, I won a gold star for my performance as a witch in Macbeth when I was in school. And
she hasn't changed a bit.
Really, I went to a number of schools. I think we counted like 15 or 16 schools all over the place. And everywhere I went, it was like, oh, our new reading today is Macbeth. And I'd go, yay. but I think it's so interesting because there's tragedy and risk really go hand in hand. And I think theater teaches you life lessons. And there's the underdog. I kind of go where risk is about the underdog. And that's kind of interesting how audiences are attracted to that and will root for the underdog. And I think it's because the underdog is always putting out the most risk, right?
Yeah. Listen, anytime you go to any show, it's not just theater. Anytime if you're into sports and you watch, let's say you watch football and both teams have adopted some awful defensive strategy. Like maybe if you're a deep fan of the game, you can understand it. But in football, you want to see the Hail Mary pass at the end is going to be on the highlight reel, not the super duper defensive play. If you're into baseball, you want the high risk grand slam situation. That's what makes the fans excited. And I think that that feeling of excitement transfers over to the theater. If you're, let's say you like watching gambling. If you're in Vegas and you're watching gamblers and you want to see something happen, you're not going to go to the nickel and dime table.
No.
To the no limit tables where they're putting down, they're borrowing money, they put down.
No, they shove all the chips forward with both hands are all in. Not the person who goes one at a time. No, that's boring. They double hand and they push it all forward at one time. And everybody's, that's cool.
And this is the vision of theater that the books are promoting. Because there's different visions of theater. You have Aristotle. He wants to talk about feelings. He wants to talk about pity. He wants to talk about fear. You have other theories of theater. There is another German philosopher, Hegel. He talked about theater as like the collision of two ethical forces that both have a degree of being right, and they just can't, there's just not enough room for both of them to exist. So their ideas of theater, they create different types of theater, and they've been done a lot. So what risk theater, I hope, will do if people are into it, and I think people are innately into risk, that you have a hero that is going all in to make this Hail Mary play, and then something, and it looks good, but then something unexpected happens out of the blue, and just changes everything, and the audience comes out just with a greater understanding of how chance really shapes our lives more than we'd like to think.
I think it's great that you're also doing it as theater, because live performance itself is a risk.
Yeah.
You go out. I mean, we used to have a band and perform, and you know, I was a singer, front singer, and you knew when you went, part of the attraction to it was what could go wrong. I mean, look at us, we're on the road 100%.
We COVID say that hits. All the time. What could
we're
go
like,
wrong?
What could go? That's Nancy's memoir. What could go wrong? Yeah. And yet you put yourself in that position. You know it. People are going, what's wrong with you? Like, we want to do it, you know? So, but theater and performance, you know, something can change the dynamic in a live production at any time. As a, you know, talk about comedy. Now that's I think comedy and risk and fear, they are all holding hands really tight. I mean, big drama needs comic relief, and comedy is not funny without the drama or the tragedy, quite frankly. It just isn't. But, you know, a comedian could go out there, have this great set, and here comes the heckler. And, you know, it's like, it's up to them. It's almost like the audience is watching now, how are you going to deal with this more than the set? You know what I mean? So I think that's another huge part of why theater and risk go hand in hand, is just that anything could happen at that moment.
For sure.
Oh, yeah. The secret of theater, in a way, and I like how you bring up the hecklers, Lisa.
Yeah.
It's the secret of live theater.
We run live radio shows. We know about it.
We know about it.
You know, the audience actually isn't on your side. The audience actually isn't on the side of the actors. Like, they want to see something bad happens. And the actor, by being a true professional,
rubberneckers,
each night on stage, has to disprove the audience. And then they get their applause for... I think it's like that for anything. For if you're a piano player playing in front of a big audience, the audience isn't there to hear you play perfectly. They secretly, I think, so, they want that piano lid to come down on your fingers. And when you're able to, like, get through your whole set without making any mistakes, to prove the audience wrong, I think that's where the applause comes from. The audience is, good job, you tonight you proved us wrong, but we're gonna come back and see you tomorrow to see if you can do the same
that
thing.
That is that you're right. True. There is that weird quirkiness about us all. Because it's true, when like we went through a series of wildfires and had to evacuate and all of these things, and just it was horrific. And also before that, went through a fire where our garage burned down. And cars were all blowing up next. It was like crazy. But it happens, you know, and it was dramatic. But, you know, we've lived all over, so we don't have huge. I mean, obviously, with us traveling, we just it's not the end of the world to us with possessions, you know. But you do lose things along the way that are very, very dear to you, and you just kind of have to go on.
Oh, well.
But the hecklers were the rubberneckers, the people who watched us. So we were in this fire. Our band had come back from a show. And we hear all these explosions, and we're living in a condo complex, and we brought the bass player. I just wanted to go home, take a quick shower, then take him and drop him off with his gear. Brand new gear over the holidays. It was New Year's Day or the day after. And all of a sudden, we hear all these explosions. And I'm like, and at that time, we were at war with, I don't know, Baghdad or something. We're like, oh, God. Because we're like, we're like, we're going down. Turns out somebody had driven into the car area and everything started exploding. Her car gas fuel pump blew and you just hear tires popping. So we get people out of their car, get them out, and we go, and the people across the street had lawn chairs set up. We thought, oh, how sweet. No. Lawn chairs were for them to sit and watch us
try to escape.
And the next day, after all drama, when we go into the rubble, into our garages that were all burned down, all our stuff gone, the other neighbors are looking and peering over, and they learned about my language. But I know, that's what they were doing.
They didn't say, can we help? Do you need anything? They were like, what did you lose? What did you lose? They were like,
so you're really right about this. That was live theater.
That's awful.
It's bad, and it doesn't surprise me.
It's funny. Either.
It's funny now, but at the time, you know, if you had a choice of either continuing to do what you needed to do to get back on your feet, or go and take one of them outside and teach them a lesson, kind of thing. Because
it was really
this is the base of humanity right here. You can't get any lower than that, you know. And so to the people in that apartment, guess what? You're low.
So this is interesting too, going to
at all
that people want to see that happen, like the, you know, the lid on the piano, on the pianist's fingers. They want to see that, but it is about, can you overcome these obstacles? So what I was wondering about your books and your competition, which we need to talk about, is the role this can play with youth and using your books, like going through the plays, and you know, we see all of these cosplay happenings. I'm not big on understanding all of that, but obviously, people, whether or not you're in the theater, they want to act out. There's my word. They want to act. They want to do these role plays, and you know, so I was wondering about that in with both books, of people not only writing and using that as some a way to write a play, but also turning around and using it with their friends and using it in education.
So the question is on how people would write risk theater,
right, but also use it in their, like, because you've got the plays in the book that they could gather with others and like do like a reading table basically, or reenact them, because so many people do these cosplay, and I don't know if I've even got the right word for that, but people are going out and doing their own kind of theater, if you will, like just out of like their favorite sci-fi things and stuff like that. But can they use your book in a way to gather with others and create their own play, like to act out what's in your book?
Why not?
Yeah, I think the cool thing about the
there you go, the tower
that's coming out is that, yeah, it does have three plays from the competition in it. So the competition has been running, yeah, it's in its fourth year now. And so there's two previous winners and a finalist. So Gabriel Jason Dean, Nicholas Dunn, and Emily McLean, their plays are also in here. They're examples mm-hmm. of these, of how playwrights have been exploring risk in their writing. And I think if people were to get together, like each year we workshop and also do a staged reading of the winning play. And when we get together to do this, we really focus on risk as the fulcrum. And when we do this, we're using the point of the exercise of this whole risk theater thing is to use theater as a dress rehearsal for life. Mm-hmm. So that you act out these characters taking these risks. And then by acting them out, you get into the mindset of the character that's very determined to be successful. And they always have a plan that nothing's gonna go wrong. They've like covered all, they've checked off all the—
Well, the what could go wrong.
Yeah. And then what these playwrights do so wonderfully is they have something go wrong, and it's something mm-hmm. out of left field that like you can sort of see it coming, but you can't. So I think in the plays, the audience can sort of see it coming because you have to set it up so that the audience is sort of knows that it's gonna happen. But the talent of these playwrights is that they can also have it so that the characters have no idea that it's coming. It's like we talked earlier about Macbeth. So Shakespeare set that up really well. If you're in the audience and they talk about Birnam Wood coming mm-hmm. to Dunstan and Hill, like you're sitting in the audience, you know it's gonna come. But he's also set that up that Macbeth, he's like, there's no way Birnam Wood's gonna come. How can the forest uproot itself? That's just illogical. So by staging these plays or performing them in whether on a stage or with friends, I think people can use theater as a dress rehearsal for life, because mm-hmm. we're never thinking about chance. We are thinking about chances. I think the last thing that people think about, I think there's something in their brain that short circuits a little bit when they think about chance. So it's not something people like to think about. And
it's
but
denial.
It's something we should think about more.
Mm-hmm. It's denial. If mm-hmm. you don't want something to happen, and a lot of people live their life in denial about things that are so obvious, that are right here in front of you. No, that's not happening. No, that's not what causes it. No, no. You know, so, and it doesn't stop what's going to happen from happening. It just means, I've always felt there's a bigger risk in doing nothing than taking a risk.
Oh.
To me, the biggest risk of all is not doing anything.
Yeah. So I'm so glad you bring that up, Nancy. Like, to me, this is so exciting. And if I could just grab onto that. So I write essays is what I do. Mm. And right now I'm writing an essay. And this is the mountain that the types of people like me, once in our life, this is the mountain that we got to climb. And that's, and it's true for actors as well as people that write essays about plays. And this is Shakespeare's Hamlet. So I'm working on Shakespeare's Hamlet, and my take is that Shakespeare's Hamlet, from the viewpoint of risk, because as you know, I'm a one-trick pony, I just look at things from the perspective of risk. So Hamlet is all about that he's cautious, and his caution is a sort of prudent. A ghost comes up to him and he's like, hey, Hamlet, I'm the ghost of your dad and your uncle killed me. And, you know, if a ghost came up to me, I would also be like, hey, I'm not sure if you're an honest ghost. Like, you know, I got to check it out to make sure. So Hamlet's really cautious. And I think the whole play is dramatizing that there's a sliding door of opportunity in life. Opportunity is like an open window that it, sometimes life just gives you that one chance. And when you blow that chance because you're risk averse, you just blown it because they're all dead in the end. And then the guy, and the most amazing thing is that the crazy guy, Fortinbras, he's been taking wild risks, like, the whole way. Like, he's fighting for a piece of land that's worth nothing, sending off 20,000 soldiers to die for, like, you can't even farm it. And Hamlet's like, he's scratching his head. He's like I wouldn't do that. But in the end, it's the risk taker that gets the throne of Denmark, and Hamlet and the whole Danish court, they're all dead. So, and that's because he was prudent. So a lot of the times people say, like, no, you can't take risks because, you know, there could be unintended consequences or this could happen. You have to play defense. Well, Hamlet is the play that Shakespeare's looking at. What if the best defense is a good offense? And if you're playing defense, you're just going to die. But then he does different things in different plays too, like in Caesar, like that you take too much risk and you die in that one. So it's
it's about balance in the end, right?
It's calculated risk. It's taking a risk with thinking it through as much as you possibly can, but you can't think it all the way through because something always happens you didn't think about because it's never happened before.
This is the first time I've been green on camera.
I think it's quite becoming, actually. I think you should keep that look.
No, see, anything can go wrong. And that's the beauty, again, going about performance. The performing arts is about that. It's about anything can happen, go beyond the story. And to me, that's the beauty of it, because musicians and performers keep putting themselves out there. Writers keep pushing the envelope. Even if you go, like, even into, you know, movies and Netflix and all that stuff, there's a risk in putting it out there, and sometimes they have to bring it back, but it's still not as much risk as doing live. There's no way when you've recorded it, it's not as much risk. But you can see the risk writers are taking now, they're pushing and pushing and pushing the envelope. It seems a little different. Have you noticed that in writing, whether or not it's plays or movies or even, you know, do we have regular TV anymore? I don't know, but these series, it just seems like writers are pushing the envelope beyond the restrictions that we used to have. And I think when you do that, you gain a whole new audience, and sometimes it just gets right in the game. It's like, that's it, you're out, and you have like a cult following. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But you almost have to, because people are pushing the envelope of, especially right now, of being who they actually are. Mm. And not being told, boy, you're this or you're that. There's a whole group of people like, I'm not either one, sorry. And they're pushing the envelope. So if you're going to be a writer, unless you're going to be always writing about what used to be, as opposed to what is now, you're going to have to address that things change. Mm. And there's always risk in change, just like there's risk in not changing. Mm. I mean, risk is going to be there no matter what.
It's a constant.
That's the cool thing, because, you know, I was, when I was coming up with it, I was coming up with this theory of tragedy, and I knew that it would be to do with the unexpected, low probability, high consequence events. Mm. And I was brainstorming. I was like, should I call it like ludic theater? Because ludic is sort of like it related to games. And I was like, oh, that sounds sort of cool. And then I had another one, and it was like aleatory theater. Is the Latin word for dice is alia. So aleatory is like related to randomness. And I came up with all these other, they're sort of loser names now. And and then it was, I came across some economics book. There was an economics guy, a mathematician and a trader. His name's Taleb, and he wrote, the Black Swan is his book, and he talks about all these big hedge fund guys. There's these people on Wall Street. They're called the masters of the universe because they have billions of dollars, and then they leverage up their bill. It's not enough to have billions. They leverage it up by like 30 to 1. So with like crazy. $1 billion, they control 30 billion of investments, and then they go all in. And his take was, you know, these guys, they take on too much risk and they blow up. And I was like, I should call it risk theater. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got the name for it. And and what I love about risk, and this is what some of the critics don't like about risk theater, they say to me, Edwin, risk, it's just too broad a term. It can mean anything. So your theory's senseless. But to me, it's risk is just fruitfully ambiguous, that you can make of it anything you want. Risk can mean aversion to risk. It can mean taking on risk. It can mean avoiding risk. So like
it's part of every decision.
Yeah, it's part and people of understand
absolutely
that.
Every decision you make. I like that you're putting it with theater, because like I said, to me that's risk, period. Mm-hmm. It is, and it's showcasing stories, but it's risk. And I think it's also really timely right now, you know, with everything that happened with COVID until now. I mean, everybody were like, they're like, oh, wow, I just emptied my savings account on a new house. Oopsie, now I don't have a job. They risk things thinking
things are going to be fine.
Things are going to be the same. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think about COVID, was a huge, I mean, here we were on the road going, uh-oh. Oopsie, we never thought of a pandemic being a risk.
Yeah.
Now we put that in there, but you know.
Yeah.
So Lisa, that's really the best example, right? So like we have these plans in our lives. I'm going to be here in 5 years. I'm going to retire in this year. I'm going to do this in that year. And then in my life, there have been a couple of big game changers that just really changed the whole world. And all those were like, they just came out of nowhere. So there was, I think 9/11 was probably the first one that I was old enough to process and comprehend and be affected by it. Then, about a decade after, there was the Great Recession sort of, no one was expecting that. Like afterwards, everyone's always like, oh yeah, we could see it coming. I had predicted this, but before it happened, no one really knows. And then it's the same with a decade after the Great Recession was the COVID that you talked about. And then that's always something after it happens, people were like, oh yeah, we knew that the some pandemic before it happened.
That was something and then everybody's like, oh, it's only a month, so let's do this. And then it wasn't a month, you know, so it is, and it's still here. It's, you know, it's a Klingon, you know, but, you know, it's just, it is what life is. And that's what theater portrays life. And I think that the acting part of it, the writing part of it teaches, but the acting part of it, we have our military history expert, Mike Guardia, comes on our show every first Monday. He's also a teacher. And we were talking about the Battle of New Orleans on an interview years ago. Mm-hmm. And many people don't know what happened in the Battle of New Orleans. And this is a small war, but it was the British, Andrew Jackson came in, the Native Americans from Kentucky and Tennessee came down. All these cultures got together that normally fought with each other and said, screw you to the British, we're taking you out. And I mean, the Creoles and everybody got together. And to teach this, the only way he could get it, because it was so, there's so many parts of this battle that happened. It was, I think, the only nice thing about Andrew Jackson, which was weird because he's the one who sent all the Indians down the Trail of Tears. And here we had the Indians help us, you know, it was weird. It was just so much to go with it, was he got his students to reenact the Battle of New Orleans. He's done it with Battle of 1812, that touches on your history up in Canada and England and America, you know, but it was, he just said that was the way for students to understand, was to make it into a play.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder about that role. The first thing when I saw your book, I thought, Risk Theater is the portal to teaching and education. That's where I was going with that, because I think for youth, to understand theater, to act it out, write it out, to read it, but to just, it's immersive and interactive.
Yeah, and what Risk Theater, I think if you're applying it to, if you're applying it to real life, it would benefit a lot of these people that are dancing on the edge, the big risk takers in the people that push things to the limits, like the people that are going into space.
Elon Musk, here we go.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
People that are going into space, the people that are building these large offshore oil rigs. I've been reading case studies on just different disasters. So there's a whole a whole thing called a catastrophe theory, and it looks at the Challenger space shuttle. It looks at what was that one? That oil rig, the Deep. I can't remember the name, but it was a movie. A little while ago, this oil rig, they couldn't put in the blowout preventer, and then the blind shear ram, that's like the last ditch thing that's supposed to stop the flow, it fails, and all the other safety devices fail. Deepwater Horizon, that was it.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
So if people that are these people, what they do is they call it dancing on the edge, because they are dancing on the edge. And these big Wall Street people, they're also dancing on the edge. So if they were to partake in a risk theater type play, they would come to understand that for the sake of safety, and it's just an old folk thing, you gotta leave some powder dry. Just for just for when the unexpected happens. If you're all in, you got no power, you fired all your shots already, you got nothing left, because
you gotta have reserve.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to have reserve.
That's why I go gambling with Nancy. Yeah, I go ask her for more money when I run out.
And I'm like, I'm like, you don't know.
This is low calculated risk. I'm going to put it all in there. It'll come. I counted it out. And then I go, Mom. Suddenly she goes from Nancy to Mom. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if you don't leave, those extra dollars in your wallet, I'm going back to gambling because I haven't done that for years. It's fun.
Oh, no.
I'm banned from it now. It's true. You're really right about that. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You just don't.
Yeah, we got all these we got all these folk sayings that have been around, proverbs or these woolly expressions that they're all to do with risk because risk has fascinated people. We think we take the biggest risk, but 100 years ago, there are people that they're saying, don't sell the farm. There's all sorts of these expressions in the language. Yeah. That
walking the tightrope.
Well, okay, but now how about the guy Icarus who decided he could fly and he makes bird feathers and wax and tries to go to the sun? Hello, what part of the sun melting wax did you not get?
Yeah, and that was...
I mean, it's funny.
That was the ancient version of you got to keep some powder dry. Back then, they keep the powder dry. They say to each other, don't be like Icarus.
You have to have reserve, both mentally, physically, and maybe resources. You have to keep reserves because if you put it all in and you haven't kept reserves, chances are you're going to lose big time.
Exactly. And there's people, I think it must be, there's some people that they're just natural born risk takers and they do fantastic things, but they also do really dangerous things. So they're good and bad. And
because there's this thing where so I think Elon Musk is an interesting one where there's this really good side and then all of a sudden he gets everybody angry and then he's good. He flip-flops, right? So do you know, you don't know if he's
for him.
The audience, all of us watching, because we're watching everybody. Look at the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp trial. Talk about they both put their careers even further in risk by televising this crazy court case of defamation, right?
That's crazy.
With all airing your dirty laundry out there, did it really solve anything for anybody at the end of the day? But this is that thing where you can get too big. And then there's this ego that overtakes that's where I think when people go all in, that that when you don't go through the steps of a play, right? You already think I'm invincible because I've done this and this, and now I don't need to think anymore. I don't need to do the logical steps. And it's like this ego belief has overtaken reality.
It's ego combined with emotion without thought.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. When you've
got ego, it's really dangerous and it's really hard to come back from. I mean, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard had done nothing but injure each other and themselves. It's going to be hard for either one of them to come back.
Yeah, and it's
point?
It's fascinating too because it's these risk takers that they change the world, that they do things Musk is a good risk taker. I remember seeing interviews with him when he was starting Tesla. Someone was interviewing him and they're saying, you already you sold PayPal, you already got billions of dollars and now you're putting it into this, well, back then it was this crappy electric car company that was gonna go bankrupt. No one knew, right? So and Tesla at that time, they were just losing billions of dollars a year. And so the reporter was interviewing Musk and he said, and she was like, well, why would you do that? And he said, it's just such a cool idea. It's the coolest idea. It's a rad idea that I'm going to build an electric car that it just looks good instead of the other electric cars that look sort of like not as good. And he's like, it's a worthwhile risk. And she was like, well, what are you going to do if you if you lose it all? And he didn't really bat an eye. He was just like, well, then he find some way of making it back. And then he sort of changed that car industry. He was like going direct to consumer sales. He didn't have showrooms, and he sort of disrupted everything because he's that risk taker. And in all these risk takers, they're really dangerous on one hand, and they're really game changers on other, because you don't know what's going to happen. Risk is the trigger. Yeah. And you like, if you have a conventional car company, they're not like gonna, oh, we're gonna like not have a showroom, like, and the status quo continues. But yeah, risk to me is so fascinating because it's that trigger. You take so much risk, and then like you don't know what's going to happen.
I think you have to have some kind of self-belief. In Musk, again, going back to him, he's interesting because they had nothing as a family. And instead of just going and getting a regular job, which, I mean, he's done that, but to go, okay, we're going to, you know, just pull ourselves out by all getting jobs, him and his family, and be that, he went, well, screw it, I have nothing, so let's go all in. I mean, there's something with that, and I wonder if that's the base of his risk, knowing he's made it without anything, that he can do that again. Well, and sure, he's got connections now. So, I mean, got to think about that part of it, where you kind of have that background. That is your background.
Yeah, they're the risk takers are the people that, for better or worse, they change the world. I've been reading like bios of like not even like entrepreneurs, but like rock stars. Right. A lot of these people that became huge rock stars, they would have a band, they would be kids, they would be 16, 17, they'd be in their early 20s, and the band would be, everyone else in the band would have some kind of a real job doing something, and then they would do the rock band on the side. Mm-hmm. But then the ones that made it, a lot of them, what I'm finding when I'm reading their bios is they're the person that never had any side gig. That rock and roll gig was their one gig, and that's they went through like horrible poverty, but they just believed that they would do it, and they're the ones that made it. They never had any backup. They never kept any powder dry. They were just all in. But
it's that personality, that personality of, I don't need reserves, backup, don't need any extra powder. I'm going to go 125%. It's never 100%. It's always more than 100% in.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go in more than 100% in, you're either really going to make it or you're really going to, you know, but they're willing to take that risk. Other people are, I'm not doing that.
That's perfect, Nancy, because just like how us in today's society, we like to talk about these people that take the risks, like the Johnny Depps or the Musks or these rock stars or these Wall Street masters of the universe, like in tragedy, in a lot of these tragedies, like here I got Sophocles, like these heroes that are in these books, like Oedipus the king, or Tamburlaine, or Caesar. A lot of these characters in tragedies, they're like these larger than life individuals that they're fascinating because they don't have this gene or whatever it is that tells them to like stand down. You gotta like. And they're fascinating to watch because, you know, like we all got a friend that does skydiving or races sports cars, or they ride motorbikes. Like everyone, we all know that person. And like, And these people in these tragedies, they're that person except 10 times as big.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they're also, they're not doing society's norm. So that's the other part of it. They're not, because they can't. You can't go all in and run a perfect household, have the perfect relationship, and, you know, run 9 to 5. You don't run 9 to 5. I think that's also, when you think about it, entrepreneur life is about risk. I remember my grandmother saying to Nancy and I, when we got back from, we lived in South Africa and Kenya, and things got a little crazy in the continent, and it was time to come home. And, you know, we were getting our feet back on the ground, and, you know, there was political stuff and craziness. And we said we'd never start. Nancy had a magazine in South Africa, and we were like, that was a lot of hard work. We'll never do that again. Of course, it's in our blood. And now we're 25 years in this country running the magazine this year. And, you know, it's hard work, and you are all in. If you get 2 to 3 hours sleep a night, you're lucky. And grandma turning to Nancy and I, why don't you both just go get a real job? What? What? And people look at us nuts, like, how can you be on the road 100%? Because that's who we are. So it's a little weird, but it's who we are. And I think that when you go against the society norm,
it's way more
people
fun.
Have that, like, but now we're getting, there's digital nomads around the world. So people there's
because
a lot of us.
They're finding out how much fun it is.
It is fun.
It's way more interesting than sitting at a desk job.
No. Exactly. So being a writer is a risk. So what I think to you is doing all this on risk.
Mm-hmm.
What has risk meant to you as an individual, and how has it helped you grow through these two books and the competition?
How has risk to me is it's just the most. I feel like really lucky that my two loves are theater, and then I also love just studying risk for all the reasons that we've been chatting about today, because it's just so fascinating. And through this risk theater project, I'm able to connect the two with a larger community. So by having the competition that's in its fourth year now, so it's awesome. It's starting to be something that people have heard about. It takes a few years to become known. I think I'm learning that you got to do something for maybe like 10 years before it really gained. Like, I'm not even there yet, but I'm able to combine these my passions, theater and the study of the unexpected, and then reach out to the larger playwriting community. And hopefully someone will hear this radio show and they'll think, oh, hey, risk, that's the coolest thing. That's something that
is cool.
I want to check out. Because if you look at theater, if you look at people that study risk, they're not usually into theater. And if you look at theater, like, to me, it's all about risk, but there hasn't been that focal point of like, oh, let's look at theater, interpret, create, and also direct theater specifically with risk in mind. So I'm hoping that by combining them, that other people are going to be interested. They'll see the radio show and they'll be like, oh, this is a cool thing. I think I should check this out. So between the first two books, the first one in 2019 and this second book that's coming out now, what I've learned is that, yeah, to talk about risk, you sort of got to go big or go home yourself.
Mm. Yeah, see, yeah. So, you had to go all in.
Yeah, you have to. What is your competition about? How does that work, your competition?
So the competition, we invite playwrights from all around the world, and we've had playwrights, it's truly international. We've had playwrights from 20 countries participate now.
That's cool.
So somehow people around the world are finding out about this. I don't know how. It'd be interesting to know how. So, and we asked them to send in plays, full-length plays that have risk as the fulcrum of the action. So someone like bites off too much risk and then unexpected things happen. And each year we have three different jurors. They're different, sometimes they're playwrights, sometimes they're theater professionals, sometimes they're directors. We've had different novelists be jurors. And then they sit down and they spend the summer looking over all the plays. And then they nominate each year they nominate a winner based on how fascinated they were with how this play treats risk. And everyone, what I found out is that every year we have different jurors and a lot of the time I'm surprised with their picks because what I discovered is that everyone just understands risk differently. That's something that was new to me. True. So the competition, it brings together a larger community of people it's okay to have the book, but then the book's like, no one's gonna read the book unless there's like an incentive to. So the competition, I love it because it creates a buzz. Like, look, there's this book, some guy's written a book on risk, but hey, there's this competition. It gives out awards over $13,000 each.
That's awesome.
Each year of prize,
that's cool.
Prize money.
That's cool.
So there's $500-$600 finalist prizes, and then the grand prize this year is I think it's $10,200. And each year we work to make it more. So hopefully more people will be interested in it. It's sort of like an experiment. And it's cool because in a couple more years, there'll be a few more winners, and then I'll come up with a second book with the winners between then and now. And if people want, they can pick up the book, they can find it at the library, and they can read these plays that
That's what's cool about it. I like the plays.
Images.
I love the tower, by the way. I love it because the tarot, it's so funny because I think risk takers get into that too. Let's see what the tarot cards do and tell us, you know.
Another guy, I loved it.
Oh, yeah, the fool. We like the fool.
So this is like, to me, this is just what the tragic hero looks like in my mind as I read these plays. They're this person, and they got their little like a Snow White dog by them. They're dancing on the edge because they're on the and he's got
idea,
happy. Right?
But he's happy.
Yeah.
He's happy.
He's really doing his thing.
That's cool. When does the competition end this year? Like when for everybody to apply or submit their
plans? It ended just a few days ago.
Oh,
last day
see
of
what
May.
Oh wow.
And so I've just sent off all the plays to the jurors, so they're gonna start reading them, and then I'll launch in another month the fifth competition, the fifth annual competition, and I'll raise the prize money a little bit. And what's going through my mind right now is, so the grand prize winner is $10,200, and then there's $500-$600 finalist prizes. I'll raise them both, but I'm wondering if I should do a bigger raise in the the grand prize winner, or I wonder if I should raise the finalist ones more, because some people,
which one has more risk?
Well,
they're the same. It's the same because you're all coming after the main prize.
Yeah, so some people have said that I should raise the finalist prize money because the differential between 10 grand and 600 is a lot. So to raise the finalist ones more. But then in the advertising, what I've noticed is when I advertise a competition, no one advertises the finalist money. They just have one line and it says grand prize winner wins 10,200.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, mm-hmm.
That's an interesting number too, 10,200.
Yeah. Oh, it started the first year, the grand prize I think was 8,000. And each year it goes up a little bit. So I'm trying to make it go up, but I just can't do it all. Mm-hmm. I just can't do it all.
It's hard work. Yeah, that's hard work.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic what you're doing. Yeah, I think it's awesome. Because it gets people to put themselves out there, right? Mm-hmm. Because even to go for competitions and awards, it's like you have to put yourself out there to apply and know that the possibility of rejection, mm-hmm. but there's a possibility of reward. And there, what is it we were talking about on the show the other day? If you don't put yourself out there, it's automatically a no.
Yeah, it's nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Exactly.
Nothing ventured, nothing gained, nothing, no risk, no reward.
Exactly. It's fun. This is fun. Mm-hmm. It's fun. Well, this has been a fun chat, and everybody, it's risktheater.com is the website. Again, the book is by Edwin Wong. It's called When Life Gives You Risk, Make Risk Theater. We say make margaritas too, but also this first book is The Risk Theater Model of Tragedy, and that is out as well. Keep up with Edwin at Edwin Charles Wong on Facebook. On Twitter, it's Theory of Tragedy on Twitter. And on Instagram, Edwin C.L. Wong. And of course, keep up with us at bigblendradio.com, where we always take risks because you never know what can happen. Today, I get to be a green person. I didn't know that. And here it is. So that's good. So thank you so much for joining us, Edwin.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been fun.
Take care, guys.